The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.
Welcome to Author Spotlight. Our guest is Alexander Anikin. Mr. Anikin is founder of Anikin Research and Management AG, an independent research firm established in October 2009, focusing on investment themes related to nowcasting, which is an interesting term. We'll have to dive into that. Nowcasting and risk management. From 1988 to 2009, he had various research functions within UBS Investment Bank in Zurich and London relating to financial derivatives, indices, capital flows, and alternative investments. He's the author of several books. We're going to be talking about his latest book here today. But before that, I did want to mention that his extracurricular activities include skiing, photography, and attempts at abstract painting that he makes public on alexart.ch. And I'm on that site now, and I have to tell you, there's no attempt being made here. This is some really cool artwork. It's very colorful. A lot of it is very dazzling, and it's not all abstract, I wouldn't say, although I don't consider myself an art historian. But let me give you that address again. The URL is alex, A-L-E-X, art, A-R-T, dot C-H. Now, don't go there yet. Listen to me. Listen to Alex. We're going to have a conversation. You want to hear about his new book, but write that down because there's some dazzling artwork on there that you're definitely going to want to take a look at. With that, Alexander Anikin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. This is a really interesting new book titled Applied Wisdom, 700 Witticisms to Save Your Assets. I like the colorful title. And I will also tell our listeners that some of your other titles of books that you've written are Asymmetric Returns, The Future of Active Asset Management is the subtitle, as well as Absolute Returns, The Risk and Opportunities of Hedge Fund Investing. And I'm probably leaving something out here, but the point being that Alex is the author of several books, his latest, again, Applied Wisdom. Now, there's applied research. There is basic research. Why applied wisdom rather than basic wisdom? You know, I don't know if people know the difference between applied and basic. Basic research is blue sky type stuff where you're spending money on trying to make big scientific breakthroughs or technological breakthroughs. Applied is we have a problem, we're seeking to solve it. So applied wisdom, I guess you're directly solving problems with this book is the whole idea. Is that right, Alex?
I think that's very close. Yeah, the term is actually the inspiration came from applied history and applied psychology. These are very old terms. I don't know, they go, I think, more back more than 100 years or so. And that gave me the inspiration for applied wisdom, because I have been using these quotes throughout my writing career, which is a bit more than 30 years now. And the feedback was always great. But it needed to be applicable, so useful. Like, applied history is not just history, you know, that might be taught at a university. It's really applied history is sort of like applying, you know, the past to solve or to analyze, you know, contemporary issues. And that's why I used the word applied rather than anything else.
Let me go back to your bio. There's that term again, nowcasting. What is nowcasting?
Well, it's sort of a pun on forecasting. I think it originated in weather forecasting a couple of decades ago. I think in the 80s or so, where weather forecasts, people always made fun of weather forecasting. And then in the 80s, computer power became cheaper and more available. So they made their models more complex as computer power was becoming cheaper. And noticed that the forecast didn't improve. And then they simplified. And then now casting is sort of like more modest than for forecasting. So instead of having just an opinion how things will turn out, you look at essentially the past. For example, in the stock market or with interest rates, you establish a trend. And then instead of forecasting, let's say in interest rates, the reversal of interest rates, which everyone has been predicting for the past 10, 15 years, which never came. You sort of like now cast as in you assume that the trend just continues. And then when you measure something, so if you measure in with objective measurements the turnaround, then the trend goes in the other direction. But it's sort of like fact-based rather than opinion-based, because a forecast is, by definition, an opinion.
Well, I like it. It's the power of now. We're living in the moment. What is happening right now? What does it tell us about what's going to happen and what did happen? Mm-hmm. Now, are you of the mind that the rules have changed? A lot of people say, oh, the rules have changed. Economics are not what they used to be because technology and science has changed all of that. Is that, does that have any credence at all in your mind? Or do you say, look, the basic, it's like the law of physics. They don't change. We have the same dynamics at work.
Well, what I would say is like change is like the, someone said that, that's not me who's saying it. I'm quoting someone, I just forgot who said that. But someone said like change is the only constant in the universe, which means everything is changing all the time. And I've got one chapter, which is called in the book, The Iron Law of Failure. So you could also say it's also a constant. Everything sort of like moves towards failure. You mentioned physics. Our sun will in a couple of billion years will turn into a red giant. Our Milky Way will collide with Andromeda. Every person alive today will die, and so on. So there are iron laws. And there's also a chapter called The Iron Law of Capital, which is sort of like a bit pro-capitalism a chapter in the book. But things always change. There are also certain things which don't change. So, for example, in relevant to financial markets is sort of like a mass psychology. I quote a lot of books. One in particular, one of my favorites, is called The Crowd. It was written in 1895. I read it very early in my career.
Is that Wilhelm Reich?
No, it's Gustave Le Bon. So it was written in French, and it was actually a mass psychology applied to the French Revolution, where the mob turned mad. But you can also use it, for the Nazi situation in the 1930s, and you can also use it for bubbles and bursts, because I think there's an underlying law like how a mob or a mass of people, go crazy in a synchronized way, so to speak.
In the United States today, the groupthink on right and left is absurd and frightening. You see what I'm saying? I mean, and I don't mean, I'm trying just to bring it home. I'm now casting right now, Alex. I mean, that we look back in history and we see these really egregious examples of groupthink or crowds and positive ones too, because crowds can do good. They can all start to actively decide we need to solve this problem. Let's work together and do that. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. we tend to veer to the negative too often. But it is very much a here and now thing. This and it certainly applies to economics. It's the expectation. How often do we talk about the business confidence and consumer confidence and the expectations people have a lot to do with whether or not they're going to spend money and so on. So how much of that is addressed in the book?
Like that groupthink is very important. Although I think I turn it around. I speak more on contrarianism. That, you know, so I make the point that yes, there is groupthink. There is the crowd, but there's also the wisdom in crowd. So, you know, if the crowd were wrong all the time, then investing would be quite easy. You would just go the other way. But it's not that easy because there's also wisdom in crowd. Like, for example, there have been tests done hundreds of years ago where a group of people needed to estimate something which is very, very difficult to estimate. And if you take an average, it was quite precise. So you can't say groups by definition are mad, but if you refer to the crowd in the US, this polarization you mentioned, that's you know, the same as in Europe. I'm talking from Switzerland, and that's actually quite I would say a Western or a global phenomena.
So let me, my understanding is you've organized Applied Wisdom, your latest book, around these time-tested principles and axioms, laws, and theories. Highlight a few, if you can. Can you touch on a few?
For example, one we just mentioned, the one discussion is the contrarianism. And I think the bottom line there is that you need to be able to think for yourself. That doesn't mean the crowd is always wrong, as I mentioned, but that is certainly one. Another one is, I quote Forrest Gump's mom, who apparently said that life is like a box of chocolate. You know, you never know what you're going to get. And that's mm-hmm. actually quite important because that refers to the ignorance of ignorance. You know, ignorance in itself is bad, but I think for an investor, the ignorance of ignorance, so if you don't know what you don't know, is really bad. So that is an important concept. Then some economic concept like the iron law of capital, which sort of like states that money goes where it's welcome, where it's well treated. So many socialists have difficulties in understanding. It's a historical fact. The number of times, let's say, socialism has been tried and failed is 100%. So the failure rate is 100%. And it has to do with the iron law of capital. So that would be another one.
And why does socialism fail 100% of the time? Because in theory, it's a nice concept in theory that we all have a role to play, that the wealth of nations is shared, and that everybody, regardless of the kind of work you do, it's got value. And so on. I'm not quoting from anything, but and I may be misinterpreting some of it. But why does it fail 100% of the time?
Well, that's I think I got that from a historian who just counted the number of times. I think the number was like 32, I'm not sure about that number, but I think he just counted the number of times it has been tried. You know, Venezuela is a recent example.
Oh, an abject failure, example of it.
Yeah, and I think it's I think I've seen different estimates, but I think what is a lot of historians I think agree is that it fails every single time because it sort of like starts a negative feedback loop and then it feeds on itself whether it's Cuba or Venezuela. Also, Britain in the 1960s and 70s, it's unemployment, often including inflation. It's economists in a couple of decades ago used to use the what is called the misery index. People don't talk about the misery index
yes.
anymore, which is unemployment plus inflation. So based on that rate, in economics, it's always depends a bit how you define things. So how do you define failure? But I think looking at the sort of like world history, I would say it's reasonable to say the failure rate is 100%. What I do in the book I think I make the statement that there was never ever an American trying to risk his life to reach Cuba, whereas a lot of Cubans have risked their life to reach America, right? It's 100% thing. You know, if you're unhappy, you never seek unfreedom, right? You never like there was never a Western German when Germany was still split, risked his life to get over the Berlin Wall and to get to the East, right?
Right.
It was 100%.
Right. In fact, they were allowed to, right? I mean, you were free to go to the East if you wanted to go to the East.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that is.
So
correct.
My point being that
the other way around was forbidden. You know?
Yes, exactly. I mean, the difference between a free society. Look, if you don't want to be here, you don't have to be here. On the other side, it was like, no, you're not allowed to leave.
Yeah,
basically a national prison camp.
Yeah, exactly.
So let me ask you about, you know, in the book, you explained what Marilyn Monroe and Mike Tyson have in common with Leonardo da Vinci, and that both Muhammad Ali and George Soros applied Confucius's wisdom. How does these sorts of observations, how does that help the readers to make prudent investment decisions or life decisions for that matter?
Well, that's a very good question, Mike. And there is an important sort of like introduction, I think in the first chapter, where I sort of like argue that if something's universal, like if you can trace an idea, a couple of thousand years back, and then you find that it's still in use today. Obviously, if you know, Mike Tyson will use different words than did Leonardo da Vinci, right? Different language, different time, different everything. But if the concept survived all this time, then it's probably quite solid. And I think that is me being trying to be sort of like juggling with these concepts or with these pieces of wisdom a bit. And there is an element I try to be, you know, entertaining to some extent. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, quoting, you know, like Voltaire and Marilyn Monroe in the same sentence. You know, it might not be, you know, this is not an academic book, right? You know, my first two books were, you know, let's say a bit more serious. You know, there were a lot of tables and graphs and, you know, serious stuff. So this is a lighter reading, trying to be playful with these some of these concepts. And I think the value added, to answer your question, Mike, is the perspective. I think it by being playful with all sorts of concepts, some of which are time tested, should broaden the horizon of the investor or give perspective, different perspectives on certain issues.
You know, Mike Tyson famously said, "Everybody's got a game plan until they get hit."
Yeah,
you know,
I'm not sure I used that quote, but I'm familiar with that.
You're familiar with it.
I think I used that quote in my book. I think I quoted him twice. I would need to look that up, but I think I used that quote. I'm certainly familiar with it.
I always loved it.
Yeah, it's a great quote because it means certain things cannot be taught. You know, you can't learn at school. You know, you can learn the basics like theory. I mean, as you know, if you study finance, you know, one of the first things you learn is the idea of diversification, which is a couple of thousand years old. But still, it's in finance we call it modern portfolio theory and stuff. It's very important to know. But you know, you learn,
and it applies to investing, I think, too.
Absolutely,
because
yeah.
you come up with a thematic investing portfolio. Let's say you come up with a theme, a thematic investing theme, and it doesn't work. It's the equivalent. I mean, all of a sudden it's failing on you. It's the equivalent of getting hit during a boxing match, and suddenly you're kind of disoriented. Now, what do you do?
Yeah.
Your game plan has been shattered, and you've got to do. So you got to think quickly, and you have to move quickly. And probably what you needed to do was be thinking about that ahead of time, knowing, look, I'm going to get hit. I'm going to get disoriented. Mm-hmm. My plan might not work. Yeah. So if it doesn't work, what's plan B? What's plan C? And, you know, just from a mental framework standpoint, how am I going to be centered enough? And, you know, how I'm going to deal with it in terms of, am I going to be meditative enough and centered enough to deal with it?
Yeah. Well, the way I use the punch in the face quote, I think, is that from that that certain things can't be taught in a sense that it's learning by doing. So, for example, I got punched in the face in October of 1987. You know, that crash. You know, the stocks I held didn't go down 20%. I think they went down like 50%. I was 20 years old or something. And that was a very good learning experience. Perhaps the best in life. And that experience is not something you can be taught in classroom. That's I think how I use the punched in the face quote by Mike Tyson.
By Mike Tyson, yeah. And then Marilyn Monroe, they did a movie. No, I'm mixing it up. Okay, they did do a movie on her, but I'm mixing it up with the James Ellroy novel that they made a movie after. Kim Basinger was in it. At any rate, I want to quote from your book here. You not only write about that, you not only say that making wise decisions or write about making wise decisions, but you also talk about avoiding bad ones. And you write, I herein also quote foolish people, not just for entertainment purposes, but because the closest we can get to wisdom is avoiding the other side of that proverbial coin. Foolishness. Mm-hmm. So why do we make foolish decisions? There's a lot of foolish people out there. And of course, it has to do with perspective. One man's folly is another man's meat and potatoes. What about foolishness that you see in the markets and all? And maybe we're seeing it right now with things like GameStop. I'm talking about Robinhood and the GameStop momentum investing. And then there's a lot of people who think the whole cryptocurrency thing is foolishness.
Yes, I think I quote a lot of philosophers saying things like, you know, it's very noble to learn from the mistakes of others. And that's fine. Of course, that's true. But I also argue that having been an investor for a long time, I'm not sure how it works, you know, and I'm pretty sure I'm not speaking just for myself, that you learn by doing, by being punched in the face. I think it comes with the territory. And what is important that you survive those punches. And you mentioned GameStop or cryptocurrencies. I mean, you can be involved in that, but the folly is if you get the position size wrong. I mean, if you either use leverage or you're over leveraged or you know, you have a large, much too large position given the volatility of these investments you just mentioned. So yes, I think folly is it is learning by doing. I think that is the bottom line.
Well, let me ask you a question here. But if we looked at Alexander Nietzsche's portfolio, would we see a man who's risk tolerant or risk averse?
I'm actually quite risk averse now. I'm 54 years old, and I'm sort of like I have a lot of hindsight, and with the benefit of that hindsight, throughout my life I probably had too much cash, being risk averse, like making money and then being very very focused on keeping it essentially. I'm a risk averse, and I'm also at an age now where I see throughout my lifetime, I've seen so many opportunities, which I missed. I think I'm good at protecting the downside. I think I'm good at that, but there's so many stuff I could have done. When I was in my 30s, the sky was blue and I didn't think of these things, but when you get older, you start reflecting a bit.
Yeah. Interesting. So, you mentioned in the book also about keeping, before I even ask you that question, I want to back up a minute. You're risk averse. You're talking about that. It sounds like you've always been inclined that way, but you also are saying, I'm at an age now where conserving cash is important. But also, do you sense anything foreboding out there right now in the economy? I mean, we have tremendous levels of public and private debt. Clearly, there's a huge power shift going on in the economy. The technology is taking us places we don't even know where we're going. We don't know where it's taking us, but there's some really wonderful things happening and some fairly scary things happening. Is part of your conservativeness right now with your portfolio having to do with that? That, you know, there's a lot at play out there that we haven't seen. We're in uncharted territory, and I feel this sense of foreboding.
Yeah, and you mentioned the overvaluation, perhaps of the tech sector, but you know that I like to think of the stock market in sectors. In the 1990s, I did derivatives research and worked together with quantitative analysts, and I think I remember they argued that in 1997 was the year where sort of like sectors became more important than countries in the developed world. So if you slice the market into sectors, then you see great differences. Yes, I'm familiar with the term. There's an everything bubble, and you know the S&P is at all goes from one all time high to the next. You know which can be scary. But I don't have any as an outcaster. I look at sort of like the earnings momentum. I don't have extremely, let's say, red flags at the moment on the earnings front. And also, there are some areas which have been neglected for roughly 10 years. And two of them are banks and energy as in fossil, like oil and gas produce. So if you're into single digit PE ratios instead of 30 plus PE ratios, then you find investments. And perhaps one more thing on your statement. When I start the S&P 500 is the best index. I mean, it has outperformed everything. And when I started in the industry, that's exactly the same, which happened for the Nikkei 225, the Japanese index. And so these things change, right? But it's as a nowcaster, I don't try to forecast when these things change. But I quote people saying, you know, stability is unstable, right? So we need to be prepared for a change.
Interesting. So would you say the S&P 500 or the Nikkei, 225? The Nikkei
225, yeah.
225. Mm-hmm. Is that another kind of another element of the wisdom of crowds, that you're taking a big, basically taking the voting of a big pool of investors? Or is there no connection there really?
Well, I think you can make a fundamental comparison. In the 1980s, the U.S. industry had big difficulties, and every process was Japanese. You know, they were leading everything in manufacturing and electronics, and you know that changed, and now it's the U.S. Which is leading. In IT, you know, like communication, I would say, you know, the Chinese are also there, and also in some consumer discretionary parts of the equity universe, that's fine. It's you can justify it fundamentally. Earnings growth is I just recently did a chart, let's say I think 20-year chart, looking at comparing earnings of the S&P with Europe. Like the U.S. earnings in the S&P 500, it's like a straight line from the lower left-hand corner in the chart to the upper right-hand corner, right? It goes up, and Europe is just flat, right? It's like a straight line with a little bit of volatility in it, but it's that they've gone nowhere. They had two lost decades, Europe, if you compare it to the S&P 500. And as an outcaster, what I tell my clients, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure that out, right? You can measure it objectively by just looking at earnings growth and earnings revisions. I also look at sector composition. You know, like for example, in the UK, there's the FTSE 100. It has like I think 1% of IT, right? So
you find it interesting though that you have the lost decades in Europe and you have the lost decades in Japan, and yet the people there will tell you the quality of life is very good. Even though they're not growing at any kind of a substantial rate, the quality of life is high. There are a lot of Americans who go to Europe and just say, you know, they know how to live over there. It's so much, it's more relaxed. They're more into people-to-people relationships. They're not all just scrambling to try to get, a yield off some investment or to advance their careers. So Is there some kind of disconnect here between growth, financial growth, and quality of life?
I'm not sure.
You chose to live in Switzerland. You're in Switzerland, correct?
Yes. I'm Swiss, based in Switzerland. I was for a while for 8 years in London, and I used to travel a lot in my 30s. So I sort of like Asia and also to the US a lot. I still do holidays doing holidays in the US with the family.
Switzerland's not a high growth market, but you find it to be appealing.
I think Switzerland geographically is in Europe, obviously. If you look at the earnings growth of a Swiss index, it actually looks quite similar to that of the S&P. So I would say that Switzerland, as a Swiss, and you need to, there's a pinch of salt here required, but as a Swiss, I would say Switzerland is an oasis in Europe. Certainly, when it comes to earnings growth, and this is something you can measure, right? You can download the data and then look how the chart looks like. It looks much more like the S&P 500, but the equity indices are not very representative of the Swiss economy, because it's like 45% is healthcare, and they have quite steady. Healthcare as a sector has quite sort of like steady growth over the past 20 years, much less volatility, like for example consumer discretionary. But yes, the quality of life is very good.
It's high. There's the food purity laws and so on that people really value. At any rate, I go over there and I don't see the fire in the belly of Americans. I mean, I love Europe. And then I come back home and I, say to my wife, they don't seem as driven though. The energy level is a little bit lower and all, and maybe that's a good thing. They probably will live longer than we do, but there seems to be this lack of drive. It's almost like a caste system in some ways. Anyway, let's get back to the book. I'm kind of meandering here, but that's okay. The way my mind works. Mm-hmm. Your book mentions simplicity. Leonardo da Vinci was mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. He's the fellow who said simplicity is the ultimate sophistication.
Mm-hmm. And, it's one of my favorite quotes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, simplicity works. It just works. And so what you're saying in the book is you emphasize keeping things simple. Mm-hmm. So tell us a bit more about your thoughts on simplicity with respect to investing.
I think you can over intellectualize things, and there is a concept from psychology which is called disrationalia, and I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but what it means is that very smart, book smart people can make stupid decisions, right? It's a concept, and I think. Simplifying. I mean, there's a difference between simplistic and simple. I think the path as an investor, when you start out, you're simplistic. You know nothing. You try. You get punched in the face, and then you learn. And then I was in derivatives research. So I did the sophistication bit. With all these deltas and omegas and gammas and stuff. But then it sort of like started to simplify. And I think a lot of investors do that. I mean, when I read stuff from Warren Buffett, I also tend to get that's what many, many investors do. And I definitely shouldn't compare myself with Warren Buffett. I apologize for that.
Okay. He's not doing so well these days, Alex. He's not doing so well. Some people think he's the world's left him behind a little bit, investing world.
Yeah.
His track record is unassailable. I mean, yeah. I'm not casting aspersions on him by any stretch, but go ahead with your point.
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember that people have written him off, I think, many times in the past, let's say 30 years or so. So he's still, I think he's still okay.
So the simplicity principle works with investing, and I'll just throw this into the mix, that there are people who say, I talk to investment professionals sometimes and I say, what's the biggest problem you see when you have a new client coming in the door? And one of the things I've been told more than once is that they have too much going on in their portfolio, that you can't really tell what's working, what's not, because it's so complicated. Another guy said, diversification, yes, but some of these people have pureed their portfolios. There's too many elements, too many moving pieces that you can have diversification without having dozens and dozens of different asset classes and derivatives and so on.
Yeah, yeah. I think that I'm sure that is true. And I think simplifying, works in life and in investment life. But it also allows to be, from a risk management perspective, it also allows to be a bit more disciplined. If you know what you're doing, I mean, I think Warren Buffett once said, risk is not knowing what you're doing. And if you have a complex portfolio and you don't understand your own portfolio yourself, then it's difficult to manage risk properly.
That's another great quote. Mm-hmm. Risk is not knowing what you're doing. And and that's why he wouldn't invest in technology for years until he befriended Bill Gates. And,
exactly.
And I think he just trusted Bill Gates to say, you should be investing in this, that, and the other thing. And so, well, Bill knows what he's doing. So he's my what do you call him? A advisor or what have you. Let's get back to nowcasting for a minute. What the nowcasting approach? I don't know. Maybe you've already kind of covered that, but I was going to ask you about the nowcasting approach to investing. Do you feel that you covered that when you were addressing it earlier, or is there something more to be said on that?
I can add some. I talked about weather forecasting. So what I do, I'm not a weather forecaster. I'm a financial analyst, and I have three sort of like lines which I look at, which is macro, which is sort of like the top down approach, looking at soft data and hard data. Again, not making predictions, but I do pay attention to predictions. So for example, when for the past couple of weeks, GDP revisions have been down in China, and they have been up in India. And what I then argue is that that's a fact. So, it doesn't mean that the economists will get it right. But the fact that they are revising downwards in China and upwards in India is a fact. And then the second line is earnings. I already mentioned that S&P going straight up and Europe not. And then the third element is I also pay attention to price. So I have sort of like a data dump every week, and I've got this traffic light system. I don't predict price, but I have a traffic light system. So something is either red or green, and it's sort of like based on trends. And then every week I have a certain amount of changes. Like for example, half a year ago it was like gold and China turned negative. And then I sort of like argue that that's a fact because it's price based. And then, I'll leave it to the investor what to do with it. But these are the three things I look at as a nowcaster, like macro.
Traffic lights have yellow too. You said red and green. Is yellow a hold or a caution?
I do have a lot of heat maps, and they sort of like there is a yellow in between. So yes, I also use.
But you
yellow,
try to be decisive. It sounds like you want to make decision. Red or green. You don't want to dawdle because yellow is dawdle. It almost sounds like that you have to be decisive.
Yeah, I simplified a bit. So in when I look at price, I like to be red or green. But for example, in earnings, when I look at earnings revisions, if something is very green, then I argue that I measured the magnitude of the revision. So if something goes up very strongly by historical standards, like two standard deviation move over, let's say, 1 month or 2 months, then it would be very green. And if it's sort of like around zero, or if it's noise, then it'll be like, pastel green or yellow if it's not going anywhere.
There's the painter in you. There's the fine artist in you, the painter. You see all the different colors and shades. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's red. There's red hot, but then there's the red that's more of a primrose.
Yeah, and I think it's it's helpful for conviction because if something like coming out of the lockdowns last year, everything was dark green, which means you had this epic base effect, and I think that's something like which I hope will never happen again, but it's everything was dark green because because of a base effect essentially, but still it was extraordinary, you know, green. And you know, now things are a bit more complicated with some Asian markets being sort of like red from a, you know, earnings and macro perspective.
So you've been investing since you were 15 years old. You have traveled the world. You've given hundreds of presentations to investors. And if the Alexander Anichin name sounds familiar, it may be because he wrote a respected and widely known paper called In Search of Alpha, Investing in Hedge Funds. That's the title. Again, it's In Search of Alpha, Investing in Hedge Funds. I'm sure you can Google that if you want to take a look at that. So obviously, bottom line, Alex, where do you see the biggest opportunities and pitfalls going forward for investors?
I mean, in markets now or generally?
Well, when you say now or generally, what is generally then?
My first two books, I like to call it my manifesto for active risk management, and it's sort of like the In Search of Alpha report you mentioned from the year 2000.
Well, let's now cast and say right now, given what you're seeing right now, where do you see the opportunities and pitfalls?
Well, I think most economies are still doing well. It's there's, you know, there are bottlenecks, but I think everything most of the things I look at are still green, particularly in energy. One of my analysis is slicing the past 30 years in a tech regime and in an energy regime. So the last energy regime was from the year 2000, I think, until 2008. So roughly 8 years. Where a lot of, you know, where things like Brazil went up a lot and Russia, and, you know, the energy, like the fossil energy sector, whereas IT did quite poorly. And I sort of like claim we're for a year, the past year, we're sort of like in that regime. So we are 1 year into that now. And what is different, in the current regime so far is that, you know, is that Brazil and gold are not doing well, and tech is doing well. So the last time around, tech corrected. So in that regime, I think it lost about, I don't have the numbers in my head, but about 70%. I mean, from peak to trough, I think the Nasdaq lost about 85% in that period, and that hasn't happened yet. So at the moment, you know, putting the start date last autumn until now, it's actually both tech and old energy as in fossil energy, are outperforming the S&P.
You know, you mentioned energy, and there are people right now who are saying the next big bubble, the dot-com bubble in energy, is going to be renewables, that there's overinvestment in renewables, that people are piling into it, and it's not going to pay off that quickly. Is there some validity to that?
Yeah, well, in August I put out a report on climate change or climate risks, and there is I found an index on Bloomberg that which is the oldest index on clean energy. And over its whole life, the compounding was like 2.3%, and I think over the same period, I think the S&P was like 9%. But I also follow solar stocks, which was one of the best, let's say, themes or industries last year, and this year it's one of the worst, or clean energy is. So these things are very cyclical, and because I promote active risk management, I think you can determine these things by looking at price and also earnings. It's a bit puzzling that clean energy is not doing that well, because all the money, I mean, now as we speak, you have world leaders in Glasgow in Scotland, you know, the talking about how important it is, and not everyone on the planet thinks agrees with that, with the notions, with the doom which is coming out of Glasgow at the moment. But a lot of money is promised to go their way, let's say smart grid, I think, is something very, very interesting. Solar will become, I expect it to become interesting again in the future. And there's also, let's say, alternative ways to participate on this whole climate change, clean energy theme. And that's through mining certain like industrial metals, like I like, for example, rare earths, but also lithium, and, you know, copper,
cobalt exactly. Also. Yeah,
definitely.
There's quite a few of them out there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an interesting approach. Yeah, because
aluminium,
you
got to
have the raw materials. Aluminum, aluminium, as you say it out in Europe.
I think that would be an alternative way to participate. That actually my preferred way.
Yeah, because you're not really picking winners and losers. It's like whoever wins and loses is almost irrelevant. If it's, they're going to need the lithium, they're going to need the cobalt.
Yeah.
They're going to need certain elements. So it's a safer way to invest, I would imagine. Although, you know, we've seen commodities go through the roof and then go through the floor.
Yeah,
but at the same time, so you can get volatility also. But it does seem like a safe way to invest instead of trying to pick winners and losers. Of course, that's what indexes are for. So you bet on the whole that whole sector rather than trying to pick winners and losers, which is always risky.
Yeah, but nowadays you have ETFs for all these sort of like sub industries, which are extremely a good practical tool. You know, many of them are in the US are quite liquid. And also with this, if you go through precious metals, industrial metals, or the mining thereof, there's some other. Fundamental factors which are favorable. So it's not just the clean energy, let's say this money coming there going into clean energy story. There's also this supply shock idea, you know, where there has been underinvestment for, I don't know, 10 years or more. And now just a couple of weeks ago, the world realized that they, you know, they can't just live off solar panels and wind power. So this is a longer term theme, you know.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Japan earlier, and I'm old enough to remember when Japan was eating our lunch. They were decimating our car industry, consumer electronics. They were dominating it. It looked like, hey, Japan's going to take over. It's going to become the world's biggest economy. And there was a lot of hue and cry that we need an industrial policy in the United States, like they have in Japan. They've got a policy. We don't have a policy. But then there were a lot of people who thought, really, do you want government to be setting a policy? Why not let decision makers, industry people out there make a portfolio of decisions, thousands of decisions a day that are reacting to the market, the nowcasting, reacting to the market, knowing what they're doing because they're closer to the ground. Government people are just not close to the ground. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But then what happened? Japan faded, and we've had the lost decades. And what we've seen is that they are now the oldest country in the world, them or Italy. It's one or the other. They're both the oldest countries in the world. Now, China now appears to be, it is ascendant. There's no question. They're a juggernaut. But there's also the demographics that say, an economist saying that China is going to get old before it gets rich because it's aging. So I'm wondering if the whole demographic thing, the aging of the population, is what kneecapped Japan and could very well do that with China. The United States, on the other hand, has always been a nation of immigrants, that we've welcomed immigrants. Sadly, it's gone the other direction recently, but that's what's kept this country young. That's why the United States hasn't aged like European nations. It's the brisk immigration. So how much do you think that plays into Japan's fall and China's potential fall?
Well, I think these are demographics are very long-term themes. And Japan, when I used to travel a lot, I used to, you know, speak with the cab drivers. And I also, when I, you know, going from the airport to the hotels, I'd like to look at the, you know, the cranes and then, you know, just to get a feel for whether there is growth in terms of, you know, like building stuff. And then at one stage, I learned that in Japan, if you see cranes, they're actually demolition cranes because, you know, the population is decreasing. And so if you see cranes, they could well be, you know, they don't need as many houses anymore, because Japan is very extreme in a sense. They don't lend. It's like the opposite in terms of immigration. They
xenophobic. People say xenophobic. They are very welcoming to outsiders as tourists, but they don't really. You know, they've got a very homogenous society, and it works very well for them in a lot of ways. But it's not a growth country anymore. And then look at Italy. Italy's same thing. Look at Europe. Europe's older, and that you're not seeing the kind of growth. So there's a very powerful thread running through all of these economies that when an aging economy does not perform well.
Yeah, I mean, Japan could be ahead of Europe in a sense of demographics, although Europe is more open than is Japan in terms of letting people in who, you know, produce more kids, essentially. You need 2.1 kid per woman just
per
to keep
couple,
the yeah you know. per yeah per, or per couple yeah to keep the population stable. And for example, Switzerland is the reason why we're doing sort of like okay-ish is because, you know, the population is growing because a lot of people want to come here, and we let them in, essentially. But other countries in Europe, they have a lot worse problems in terms of immigration, and it certainly has an impact. Although there's this one idea that if you measure economic well-being, for example, by measuring GDP per capita, then there's only the productivity which matters in the long term. So demographics, once adjusted for the number of people, doesn't matter that much. I'm not sure that's true, but it could be.
So Alexander Nychin has been our guest. He is the author of Applied Wisdom, subtitled 700 Witticisms to Save Your Assets. And he is also the founder of Nychin Research and Management AG. Again, an independent research firm founded in October 2009, which focuses on investment themes related to nowcasting, which we've been talking about, and risk. And he is also an artist. As we wrap this up, I now urge you to go to his URL, alexart.ch. Dazzling work there. You do beautiful artwork, Alex.
Thank you very much, Mike.
How much time do you spend at that? How many hours per day or week do you figure you spend at it?
I do 200 hours per year. So that's about 4 hours per week. That would be my guess.
Is that by design? I mean, do you literally?
No. No. I just guessed it once because I know I'm a fan of Malcolm Gladwell, his books, and he has this book Outliers, where he sort of like quotes research saying that to be good in something you need 10,000 hours. So I want to know, where do I stand in my painting? And I think I'm about 2,000 hours. So, you know, that's why
you're at about 2,000. And yeah. Gladwell says you need how many?
10,000.
Well, I got to tell you, your artwork, you've mastered it. Look, I'm not an art critic, but you've definitely mastered in terms of just great visuals and appeal. You've definitely mastered it. You seem to have I don't know if it's a natural talent for it, but it's some beautiful stuff and very, very dazzling stuff.
Thank you.
So,
thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we'll go ahead and wrap things up then, Alex. You stay with me as I go ahead and stop this recording.
But okay, yes.
Mm-hmm. Alex Nychin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast has been sponsored by Juniper Square. Juniper Square is transforming the private capital markets industry with solutions and services that streamline fundraising, investment operations, and investor reporting. Designed for commercial real estate, Juniper Square is trusted by hundreds of investment sponsors to manage more than $1 trillion in real estate investments. Reach Juniper Square at junipersquare.com.